It is a privilege for me to stand before you, a congregation of God's people, to speak God's word and to edify and to encourage us. And I pray that it's not all just blah, blah, blah. I need that prayer, and I'm grateful for it. So, in 499 BC, this is somewhat what the world looked like over there in the old country. Now, if you're reading carefully, it says in the time of Esther, which is actually 20 years later or so. So don't get too technical on me. You'll notice that this area is part of Persia because it is under Esther's or Xerxes' rule, but it's not in 499 BC. In fact, part of what we're about to talk about is how this will become part of Persia. But what I want you to notice from this big picture is how huge this country is. There are approximately 3,000 miles between those two lines. You've probably heard of a country that's roughly 3,000 miles wide. And there's about 1,500 miles between those two lines. And you've probably heard of a country that's somewhere around that, maybe a little bit bigger. So what you notice here is this is huge. This is no small property under the great king. What we're going to look at right now for the next minute or two is what's going on over here. Now notice, this part, at this time, 499 BC, this part of Greece is owned by the king. This part isn't. Remember, we're going to talk about how that ended up being owned by Greece. But right now, this is owned by Persia. This part is not. So here we are. We're going to zoom in a little bit. And we're going to talk about a guy named Aristagoras in the first Ionian Revolution here. So here's Ionia, and it's basically this whole part there. And in Ionia, there's Miletus, which is where this guy, Aristagoras, is prince. So Aristagoras is prince over here in Miletus, and he wants to rebel from Darius, the king of Persia. So he goes over here to Sparta, ruled by a king, Clemenus, or Cleomenes, or however you want to pronounce it. And he goes over to the Spartans, and you know what they're known for. They're known for being soldiers since their youth. I mean, they can beat up anybody. And he goes to them, to the king, and there are actually usually two kings in Sparta right now. The other one's kind of absentee. So we got King Cleomenes, and he approaches him, and he says, look, over here, we are Greeks. We are your blood. But right now, we're in slavery to Darius. And so what I'm coming over to here for you to help me with is set us free. Come over and fight with us and help set us free. And it'll be easy for you. You're the Spartans. And then he also says to them, and guess what? Up here in Sardis, there's a whole bunch of wealth, and then you just kind of march on, which is going to be like way over here to Susa, which is where Darius is. And that's all you got to do. And once you've done it, you'll be wealth. You'll have wealth that compares or rivals Zeus in his wealth. And he laid it on thick. And Cleomenes, the king of Spartans, said, by sunset, you better be out of Sparta. He didn't take the bait. So, this guy Aristagoras, I can't draw on that map, goes up to Athens. Now in Athens, there's a democracy. There's ruled by the people. And so here he goes to the king. There he goes to the ecclesia, the church, or the ruling people. Let me rephrase that. It's not the ruling people. The people are the rulers. He goes to their session when the people are in to make decision. And so he calls them in, and the people come in. It usually starts at 6 o'clock in the morning. And if there weren't enough people, there would be thousands of people in this audience to hear about what are we going to talk about today. And if there weren't enough people to make a decision, they would literally go get a red rope, and they'd go down to the market or the agora, and they'd just start roping them in. Come in, it's your turn to do your, you know, that's the way it goes. So he's talking to these people, and he lays it on thick. I mean, he lays it on thick. First of all, Miletus is actually a colony of Athens. But Athens hasn't been doing it. Miletus is under the control of Darius. And so he says, you can have it all. You can have great rig. You can have it all. And the people, the more he laid it on, the more they were convinced. And so they sent 20 ships from Athens over to Ephesus. They get out at Ephesus, and they walk up to Sardis, and they burn it. And Herodotus, the historian, will write these were the ships that were the beginning of evils for both Greeks and barbarians, being the Persians. Now, Herodotus is a book about that thick. He's a historian that writes about Greece and Persia, and his main purpose in his book is to say, what happened? He grew up right after Persia had come over and destroyed all of Greece. And so he's writing what in the world happened just before I was born, or actually while I was still alive. And that's the whole purpose of the book. And he says, look, these ships were the beginning of the problems. So Darius, who was way down there in Susa, the king of Persia, hears that his city Sardis, which is a big city for them, has been burned. And he says to his slave, every time I eat, three times repeat, remember the Athenians. Remember the Athenians. Remember the Athenians. And it wasn't that he was remembering them to forgive them. So, Darius comes over and he ends up fighting in Marathon, which I covered, which is right there. They lose. And Darius doesn't stop repeating, remember the Athenians. Now, that just gets him to be a little bit more ticked off. But he'll die, and his son Xerxes will come over, and he'll cross the Hellespont with an army that Herodotus says takes 7 days to get from one side to the other side, continually constant marching over two bridges. This army, nobody's ever seen anything like it. He's got, from my edition, which is horrible, I think something like 1,700 boats, including. And so he'll go up, and he'll march all around, and he'll come down, and then there'll be the Battle of Thermopylae. And then later on, in AD 79, he will burn Athens. He has sent all of these people running to the hills, running down to Salamis, running down here. They're running. The Athenians are everywhere. And I wonder if any one of them ever thought to themselves, you know, 20 years ago, we made a mistake. Oops. Boy, did we get duped. Now, what Herodotus the historian writes about this, I find profound. It seems easier that it is easier to fool many men than one. Cleomenes, the Spartan, was only one, but Aristagoras could not fool him, though he managed to do so to 30,000 Athenians. Now, to me, and I'm guessing it does to you, I think that there's some similarity here between fooling the many men of the democracy of Athens and fooling the many men of the democracy of America. Let me illustrate it this way. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on regarding climate change, there are a lot of people that are deceived. It doesn't matter which side is true. I mean, I have my opinion, but it doesn't matter. There are a lot of people of the people, and also down there in D.C. Now, in 5 weeks and 2 days, we will have Election Day. I will preach, Lord willing, several times between now and then because Jonathan has set it up that way, not because I asked him to. Today, a Christian's response to the political situation, part one. Note well that a democracy as a form of governance is not perfect. In fact, it has some serious flaws. Now, this is not going to be a law or a lesson in civics, okay? We're going to go through some of it. We're going to deal with some of it. But, so a democracy is a people rule, okay? That word people can refer to several different things. I'm not going to get into that. Just the idea that the people rule. When the people rule, it's not perfect. In fact, it has some serious flaws. The king wasn't deceived. The people were. In Acts chapter 19, here's an illustration. Now, I understand that Acts chapter 19 is written under an empire, but you will see Greek words of Greek institutions and concepts in a Greek city, leftover ideas, vestiges of their democracy. Acts chapter 19. At that time, verse 23, there occurred no small disturbance concerning the way. So Paul had been preaching here. And in Ephesus, Verse 24, for a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made shrines of Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen of the similar trades and said, men, you know our prosperity depends on this business, and Paul's preaching against it, and they get all in an uproar. Verse 28, when they heard this, they were filled with rage. They began crying out, saying, great is Artemis of the Ephesians, and the city was filled with confusion. They rushed with one accord into the theater, dragging along Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia. And when Paul wanted to go into the assembly, here's our word, demo. Demos. Remember I said earlier that this word can take on different ideas. Here's that word. They ran into the demos. And they were shouting, verse 30, Paul wanted to go into the demos, the assembly. The disciples would not let him. Also, some of the Asiarchs, who were friends with him, sent to him and repeatedly urged him not to venture into the theater. So then, some were shouting one thing and some another for the assembly, and here's our word ecclesia. This is a different, both of these are technical terms for vestiges of democracy that used to be in Ephesus. Verse 32, so then some were shouting one thing and some another, and the assembly was in confusion, and the majority did not know for what reason they had come together. You get that idea when you look down there in Washington, D.C., don't you? Some of the crowd concluded it was Alexander, since the Jews had put him forward, and having motioned with his hand, Alexander was intending to make a defense to the assembly. Here's your demos again. Verse 34, but when they recognized he was a Jew, a single outcry arose from all of them. They shouted for 2 hours, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. And after quieting down the crowd, the town clerk. And you know the rest of the story. But what you have here is chaos. And this is what's left over of a democracy. This part is still democratic right there until the one ruler comes in and says, knock it off. And then you have something else going on. Now, chaos in the democracy, but here comes the one ruler and he says, knock it off. But there wasn't always the one ruler to come in a democracy and say, knock it off. In fact, that's the idea of a democracy. There is no one ruler. Which allows for some problems in a democracy. Here's our map again. So in 406 BC, the Spartans and the Athenians are in a naval battle against each other up here. The Spartans lose, the Athenians win. But 25 of their ships are destroyed. 25 of their ships are destroyed. So the remainder of the Athenian ships go out to get them, to rescue the people. But a storm blows up, and they can't rescue them, and the ships go away, and thousands upon thousands of Athenian sailors die. The generals who are here, something just happened, up there in this city, okay, go back to Athens. And when they get back to Athens, they are immediately called into the assembly. The people's grief was whipped up into a fury because thousands of their sailors, their boys, had died. These generals, the generals had tried. But that didn't matter to the people. So they decided, hey, you know what we should do? We should try them all as one man. There are 6 generals in front of us. We need to try them all as one man. Somebody who understood the Constitution said, that's unconstitutional. When it was objected that it was unconstitutional, the howl went up that it was intolerable if anyone should prevent the people from doing what it wanted to do. We are the people. This is what we want to do. And they took them out and they executed them. Innocent people. Dead. At the hands of a democracy. Peter Jones, who writes a book, he's a classicist, says, there could be no more vivid verification of where power ultimately, or that should have been lay, in a radical democracy. So it's radical, not in the sense of the idea, we get, well, that's radical, as in, it's outlandish, but it's radical back then, because who had ever heard of a democracy before Athens? It's radical. A democracy is, well, he's saying, look, this illustrates where the power is. Yes, the people have the power, and guess what they did? They killed innocent people. It's out of control. So back there in Persia, where's my book? In Persia, when Darius, who we read so much of in the Bible, when he comes to be a king, all right, he overthrows, he and several other people overthrow whoever's ruling right then, a guy named Sirtis. And so they're debating, what kind of a government should we have? And the first people say, we want a democracy. And then the other people, we know what they end up with. They end up with Darius the king. The man who argues for a king argues this way. When he proposes to turn over to the many, let's have a democracy. When this man proposes to turn over to all the people, he has fallen short of the nicest judgment. That's a nice way of saying he's not thinking of them. There is nothing stupider, nothing more given to outrage than a useless mob. Yet surely the men who are fleeing the outrage of one despot to fall into the clutches of the outrageous many, of whom too there is no restraint, is in no way bearable. Look, yes, you might fall into the hands of the king, but if you fall into the hands of the many, there's going to be nothing to stop you. The despot, if he does something, does it of knowledge. But knowledge is what does not inhere in the many. The many don't have knowledge. They rush into things and push them this way and that without intelligent purposes, like a river in the winter. You might have heard of this guy, Aristotle. He said, when the Athenian people became master of the courts, they became master of the constitution. You ever hear anything like that before? This general idea? When they become masters of the courts, they become masters of the constitution. Now, who are these people that are masters, became masters of the courts? Don't worry, we'll get into our Bible in just a minute. Well, here's this Aristophanes. He writes, he's a playwright. This is what he writes about one of his characters. He loves it. This juror business. There's a guy who loves being a juror. Oh, he just loves it. He groans if he can't sit on the front bench. He doesn't even get a wink of sleep at night. But if, in fact, he does doze off just for a moment, his mind still flies through the night to the water clock. Now, the water clock is what they use to time the speeches of the defendants. This man is looking at the water clock. He doesn't care what the defendant is saying. He's waiting for the time to run out. Now, what's going to happen when the defendant is done? Straight after supper, he shouts for his shoes, and then off he goes to the court in the early hours and sleeps there, clinging to the column like a limpet. That's when you go to the ocean, you see that little thing, barnacle, looks like stuck on the rock that you can't get off? That's what, look, he's stuck there, because he's going to be first in line to be the juror. And through bad temper, remember that word, bad temper, he awards the long line to all the defendants. The short line means not only are you innocent, but the long line means you're guilty and we are going to give you the harshest punishment. This man has no concern over the guilt or the innocence or justice of the defendant. And then he comes home like a bee with wax plastered under his fingernails. And because he's afraid someday he might run out of voting pebbles, that's, are you guilty or innocent is the voting pebble. If you're guilty, then it's the wax line. He keeps a whole beach in his house. That is how mad he is. Here's another of his plays when he's addressing the sycophants. We've heard that word before. The sycophant is somebody who butters up to somebody else just for their own personal good, and also for lawyers who make a dishonorable living out of financial wards of winning cases. Now, just listen if you've ever heard of this before. Here's the just man. The just man says, how do you live then? And what do you, and what on if you don't do anything? The sycophantus says, I am a supervisor of public affairs, private affairs too, everything. Oh, who put you onto that game? I do it because I enjoy it. And you call yourself a good citizen, you who break into people's homes and get yourself loathed for meddling with things that are none of your business? Oh, so serving my country to the best of my ability is none of my business? Then serving one's country means playing the busybody. You see them going back and forth. Giving one's support to the established laws and stepping in to prevent offenses being committed, that's service to one's country, the just man. But hasn't the state put jurors on the job precisely for that purpose? Yes, it has. But who is to bring the charges is the question. Anyone who is willing, the just man says, and the sycophant says, well, it is I who am willing. So the government of the country falls to me. This is not foreign to us at all. This has been going on for many years in America. As long as I have been able to be aware of politics, this has been going on in America. All of this under a democracy. And if you make a rule to deal with this, if you make a law to deal with this, you just create another person who's going to find another loophole, and you're not going to change the heart, you're just going to change some behavior, and it will go on and on and on and on, because a democracy has flaws. Now again, this is not new to us. We reckon America's problems, what we're dealing with right now, nothing that has not happened before. So, compare Judah in 700 BC. Now, don't get me wrong, I understand that Judah is a monarchy. But look at the situation in Judah around 700 BC. Politically corrupted, Judah has become politically corrupted, and the government is not doing its job. Isaiah 1:23, your rulers are rebels and companions of thieves. Everyone loves a bribe and chases after rewards. They do not defend the orphan, nor does the widow's plea come before them. Now, it is no longer the job of government to defend the orphan or visit the orphan and the widow. That is now the job of the religious. That's what James tells us. But back then, it was a theocracy. The religious were in the government. The government isn't doing its job. Really? The government's not doing its job. In fact, they are people who love a bribe. Anybody pay any attention to the news right now? One of our contestants that we will vote for in 5 weeks and 2 days seemingly loves a bribe. Worthy, dependable, respectable rulers are disappearing. The mighty man and the warrior, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the honorable men, the consul and the expert artisan, they are gone. Who is to run in 1 Chronicles chapter 13? David has of the sons of Issachar men who have understanding of the times and knowledge of what Israel should do. I look out, I see what's going on, I understand. Yeah, this is reality. There are problems out there, number one, and they also know what to do. That's what you want. Here, no more, they're gone. Remind you of any situation that you've ever heard of before? Qualifications of rulers are, because these people aren't available anymore, they got to lower the standard of who's going to be elected into office. When a man lays hold of his brother in his father's house, saying, you have a cloak, you should be a ruler. Okay, you got a jacket. Be our ruler. But the ruler says, no, I don't want to do it. The qualified people, those who are qualified to rule, refuse the job. How many times have you heard that there are good men in America, but they won't run because of the process of running? Their character is destroyed by this process. There are some good people out there, but they won't run. Instead, the inexperienced and unwise lead. I will make mere lads their princes and capricious children to rule over them. The word capricious means given to sudden and unaccountable changes of mood or behavior. And now, if you watched Monday night, you've got the other person that was standing behind the podium, on the podium. This is the political situation. And then there are the people, the societies. Woe to those who call evil good, good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness. Does that ring a bell? If a man walking after wind and falsehood had told lies and said, I will speak out to you concerning wine and liquor, he would have been spokesman to this people. This is describing our society, right up and down. Now, I realize that Judah was a monarchy. And think about it. If you're a righteous person living in this time, you know what's going on. You see it. You go out. You see it everywhere. And you wonder, Lord, I'm speechless. I can't even. And what does God say? Isaiah 33. Oh, by the way, Assyria's coming. Yeah. Talk about political upheaval. They destroy most of the country. And then after Assyria, Babylon. And then after Babylon, Persia. And then after Persia, Greece. And then after Greece, Rome. 700 years of chaos and confusion. What are they going to do? Let me tell you, if they're worrying for 700 years, they are going to fall apart. There's got to be something better. Despite living in this, there has to be something better. Isaiah 33. Isaiah 33, verse 1. Woe to you, O destroyer. Okay, I think this is talking about Assyria. It's either Assyria or Babylon. I'm going to say it's Assyria, and you can correct me later. Woe to you, O destroyer, while you were not destroyed, and he who is treacherous, while others did not deal treacherously with him. As soon as you finish destroying, you will be destroyed. As soon as you cease to deal treacherously, others will deal treacherously with you. Okay, somebody's coming to beat up on Jerusalem. And God is saying, I see you coming, but I am in control. And on my timing, you will stop. And then the tables will be turned. Verse 2. O Lord, be gracious to us. We have waited for you. Be our strength every morning. Our salvation also in the time of... So in this chaos, some people are saying, Dear Lord, be there for us. Now, do they see all this? Yes, they do. Does it affect them? If they're human and they care, it does. But throughout it all, what are they saying? As much as they experience anguish here, they are saying, Lord, please come. Please help me through it all. Verse 6. And is the first word, and now listen to these eight words. He will be the stability of your times. Which times? All 700 years. You're going through chaos. It isn't what it used to be. We talked about that this morning. It's not the way it was when I grew up. It's not the same country. It's not. It's not. Dear Lord. He will be the stability of your times. We sing the song, The Wise Man Built His House Upon the Rock, right? And we sing it for children, don't we? The word here the NIV talks about is your sure foundation. The wise man looks to God. When there's political chaos going on, and the wise man is affected by it, because he's wise, otherwise he wouldn't be affected by it. He looks to God, because God will be the stability of your times. How about a little perspective here? Isaiah chapter 6. In the year of King Uzziah's death, King Uzziah was good. He was a good man. He made a mistake. And he paid for it for the rest of his life. But he lived quite a long time. His son was co-king with him. His son was a righteous man. This good man, in the year of his death, and Isaiah, who probably only ever knew King Uzziah in his goodness, wonders, what's going to happen? I saw the Lord sitting on a throne. Lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings, and with two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And the one called out the other, saying, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out, and the temple was filling with smoke. What's going to happen? There's going to be changes coming, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And God says to him, look at me. Yeah, it's God doesn't deny anything. He wrote everything that we just read up there. But even in spite of that, he says, look at me. I know it's chaos. I know. It's not fun. I know it's nuts. I wonder if God ever used the word it's nuts. No, not that we've read of. But the idea, it's nuts down there. Look at me. He will be the stability of your times. In the next 5 weeks and 2 days, and whatever happens afterwards, He will be the stability of your times. He's not the only one to receive this sort of revelation. Ezekiel chapter 1. This is 200 years later. Or not 200, 150 years later. So, verse 1, Ezekiel 1:1. Now it came about in the 30th year, on the 5th day of the 4th month, while I was by the river Kibar among the exiles, the heavens were open, and I saw visions of God. Verse 2, on the 5th of the month, in the 5th year of King Jehoiakim's exile, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest. Okay, a couple things about the dates. Verse 2, I know for sure. It's somewhere around 593, because you do the chronology. And so what's going on here is, it's the 5th year of King Jehoiakim's exile, which means Zedekiah is king back in Israel. Zedekiah is king. He's a nut. Jeremiah's back there prophesying. Zedekiah is throwing him into the prison. It says, the accounts in Kings and Chronicles say that the people have just let themselves go. They're doing every kind of sin they can. They are rebelling against Babylon. When God had told them, don't you rebel against Babylon. Verse 1, in the 30th year, I take this to mean in Ezekiel's 30th year. I don't have concrete proof of that. But in verse 3, it says, when he was the priest. If turning 30, he would have become active duty as a priest. But he's not a priest. He's in Babylon. Is he wondering, Lord, what is happening? What's going on? We are your chosen people. Jeremiah's back there. He's saying 70 years. Does Ezekiel know that? We have no idea. Maybe he's seeing, what is happening here? And it's only getting worse. And you know the rest of chapter 1. He sees a vision that nobody can explain. The end of it. Verse 26, first of all, he sees God's servants. And you say, wow, those are some servants. And it's an argument from the lesser to the greater. If those are the servants, then the one whom they serve is even greater. Verse 26, above the expanse, there was something over their heads, the servants' heads. Something resembling a throne, like lapis lazuli in appearance, so very blue. And on which resembled a throne. High up was a figure with the appearance of a man, and then I noticed his appearance of his loins, and upward something like glowing metal that looked like fire all around it and fire within, and from the appearance of his loins on downward I saw something like fire, and there was a radiance around him, and as the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance and likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, it didn't matter anymore what had happened, or what's going on politically. Isaiah chapter 6 was fun. Don't turn there, we've already read it. In the year of King Uzziah's death, what's going on? Look at God. Let me change this a little bit. In the year of the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne. I'm not even about to compare that justice with this guy Uzziah. But if I were, the point would be, okay, great man, fantastic, did a lot of good things, but guess what? There's God. That's what we need to think about. Primarily. Revelation. I skipped Daniel. Revelation. Revelation chapter 1. I, John, your brother and fellow, verse 9, partaker in the tribulation in the kingdom and the perseverance of Jesus. Okay, understand, John has had the mystery revealed to him. He is a servant of the Lord. This mystery is, for thousands of years, God has kept it a secret, that everybody will get the gospel, and that God's kingdom will be set up and has been set up, and God will take care of his people. And now John is in prison. I don't know if I were you or if I were him, I would be thinking to myself, what's going on? Just like John, who was in prison, sent to Jesus and said, what's going on? What's going on? Verse 12, I turned to see the voice that was speaking with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the middle of the lampstands, I saw one like a son of man, clothed in a robe, reaching to his feet, girded across his chest with a golden sash. His head and his hair were white like white wool, like snow, and his eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze when it has been made to glow in the furnace, and his voice was like the sound of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in its strength. When I saw him, I fell at his feet like a dead man. And he placed his right hand on me, saying, do not be afraid. I am the first and the last, and the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive evermore, and I have the keys of death and of Hades. Look at me. Look at this. Yes, chaos, look. Look up there. Does it hurt when we see decline, moral decline? Yes. Does it hurt when we see decline of the nation? Yes, it hurts. Depravity, yes, corruption. Do these things hurt? Yes, they do. They hurt even more because you know it. And they hurt even more because you try to fix it, but you are not successful. I try. The more I try, the more sweat I have in it. I'm leaving everything out there on the floor, and guess what? Nothing is changing for the better. It's getting worse, and it's getting worse, and it's getting worse, and my children are going to be left with something worse, apparently. Does that hurt? It's like a dream where the bear is attacking you. Your gun is right there. And for some reason, there's an invisible wall keeping you between yourself and your gun. You can't get at your gun. And you wake up dead. What is going on? Does it hurt? Yes, it hurts. But he is our stability. He is our stability. In Isaiah, say to the righteous, it will go well with them. It will. Say to the righteous, it will go well with... This is Revelation, right? That's the story of... It will go well with them. Why? For they will eat the fruit of their actions. Now, the title of the lesson is A Christian's Response to the Political Situation. Here's the answer if you want it. They will eat the fruit of their actions. That's a long way of saying they better be righteous. What's your reaction? You'll be righteous. But this implies something. God knows. And he is watching, and he is going to reward you. God knows. Is it chaos? Yes. Is it getting better? No. But God knows what you are doing, and he is going to reward you. He is our stability. Philippians chapter 4. You might have heard of this verse before once or 10,000 times in your life. Philippians 4, verse 5, the Lord is near. That's enough. Do we need to read anymore? At hand. He's around us. We can't see him, but he's here. Be anxious for nothing. You mean even politics? Really? Does this apply to politics too? Because I have a hard time applying this to anything, including politics. Be anxious for nothing. Now, this does not mean we are taken out of the world. We go around and just we're Pollyannish. No, that's not the way we are. But keep perspective. In everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Jesus Christ. Matthew chapter 7. For this reason I say to you, do not be worried about politics as to what you will eat or what you will drink. Even if you're not allowed to drink, what, a 24-ounce soda? Insanity? Yes. Does it really matter? Don't be worried, nor for your body, as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food? And the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, that they do not have politics, nor do they reap, nor gather into barns. They do have a pecking order, though, don't they? And yet your heavenly Father feeds them, and you, are you not worth much more than they? And who of you, by being worried, can add a single hour to his life? Try jumping off the earth. Can you do it? No. Worrying does not help you. It cannot help you. The only thing that can help you here is God. And why are you worried about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow, and is thrown in the furnace, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Do not worry then, saying, what will we eat? And what will we drink? Or what will we wear for clothing? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for each day itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Now, I am not saying remove yourself from the political situation. I am not saying that at all. I'm saying have the right perspective. Don't worry. God has got it under control. Marcus read, we inherit a kingdom which cannot be shaken. What's going on around us right now? A whole lot of shaking. There's a lot of shaking going on right now. And we're dealing with it. Whatever happens, it might be great what happens in the next. It might be, you know that. It might not be. Whatever it is, we have a kingdom that will not be shaken. Do you remember this guy called Noah? Do you remember who he was? What God did with him? Can you imagine the logistics? He's a logistics man. Of taking this man and bringing him through the flood. The flood. Big deal. God took him through it. He was fine. It worked out all right for Noah. Moses, in a basket, in a crocodile-infested river. I mean, come on. And that's not all. He's fine. He really turned out just fine. God took Adam from a piece of dirt and brought him to be something like you and something like me. Now that's just amazing. I'm telling you that if somebody can do that, then they are worthy of being trusted and everything will be fine, and you know that already. God takes his son, deity, and from deity, and I'm not saying he removes deity from him, from deity, there's this plan that was well before the establishment of the earth. God takes deity, brings his son through chaos into the world, adds humanity. I don't even know what that means. If God can do that, then he's got you covered. And then he takes that son, kills him, and brings him through death and back to life. If there's somebody who can do that, then whatever's going on politically, don't worry about it. Psalm 118, 8 and 9. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes. And here are your options. It doesn't matter what form of governance you have. It's either man or God. It doesn't matter what form of government you live under. You are either going to trust in that form of government, which means you're actually trusting not in the form of government, but those who are in the governing positions, man, or you're going to trust in God. And no matter where you live, unless you are king of the world, or king of your own little place, island, you will have to put your trust in God. And at the same time, live in the political situation. You have to. But you must put your trust in God. So what is the Christian's response to the political situation? He must cling to God. It doesn't matter what political situation is, good or bad, monarchy, democracy, it doesn't matter what it is, we have to cling to Him. He's the one. He will be your stability. Man will not be your stability. Let's illustrate it this way. Do not allow yourself, or let me tell you this, do not allow yourself to become distracted. Don't. That's the idea. God. Yes, politics, but God. God. Don't forget about God. Don't allow yourself to become distracted by the very thing that causes unrest from the very God that brings peace. Start with this. God is the only thing that brings peace. He is. That's it. You're done. God brings peace. Now, if we start looking, there are different categories of distractions. One distraction, let me illustrate it this way. A young man is driving his car down the road, sees a pretty girl. And he's driving and he goes like this. And bam! Runs into a tree. Now, in this illustration, the pretty girl did not cause the problem. She didn't cause the harm. The tree caused the... So, she's the distraction, but the unrest comes from the tree. Let me illustrate it another way. That's closer to this. Young man has wonderful girlfriend. Beautiful inside and out. Sees pretty girl. Looks at her. And that pretty girl who sees him looking at her runs up to him, punches him in the face and kicks him in the shins. She has become the distraction and the thing that caused the unrest. If the real girlfriend didn't already, quack, 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 right? But he's got this wonderful girl right here. It's all he needs. And he looks over here, and she is the distraction, and she causes the unrest. If she, you would say, you've got this wonderful girl right here. Why in the world did you look at this one? That was so stupid. You've got God here. Why do you allow yourself to become distracted with democracy? Distracted. Not involved. Distracted. God. Yes, you have to live. He didn't take us out of the world. We have to live under the government, whichever one it is. We are sometimes involved in that government, whichever one it is. But our distraction should not take us away from God. Democracy entices one into having a false sense of power. Let me go through this real quick. When democracy is healthy, the reasonable person has power. When a democracy is unhealthy, the reasonable individual does not have power. Because whether or not it's healthy, and it doesn't matter what government it is, it depends on the reasonableness of the individuals. And reasonableness is obviously tied to God's principles, right? But so you have reasonable people. When the democracy is healthy, that is, when everybody's reasonable, it's fine. But when democracy becomes unhealthy, everybody's unreasonable except for the few. Well, guess what? The few who are reasonable no longer have any power. So what happens? Well, he still thinks and operates as though he has power. It's a democracy. I've been voting for 50 years now, and it's always worked. Things are going off. They're going off the rail. What do? I put more effort into it, and more effort into it, and more effort into it. Is there anything wrong with putting more effort into it? Maybe. If you are forgetting that it's God who is in control, and if you're handing over too much of your resources to Him, God did not take us out of the world. But be careful, as with anything, everything in moderation. When power finally fails him, he is in danger of going into withdrawal. He might complain, he might even go into despair because of the fact that he trusted in man. That was the issue. The ultimate enticement is he is blinded to the fact that he is not looking to God. Maybe he never had been. You know, I read from Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah, in the year of King Uzziah's death, sees this great vision. Many commentators believe that Isaiah had his eyes full of the throne over here when he should have been looking at the throne up there. I don't know if that's true. But it betrays the idea that this could happen to us. I'm looking at my former government. We can fix this. We can still fix this. I'm going to try harder because we can still fix this. And I've got my eyes full of the ballot box. Last verse, Matthew 18. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks. Verse 7. For it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come. Verse 8. If your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than to have two hands and 2 feet and be cast into the eternal fire. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it up, throw it out from you. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be cast into the fiery hell. This applies to politics also, folks. If it has become a distraction of your trust and service to God, get rid of it. Don't even pay attention to it until you can handle it appropriately, as with anything in this world. Thank you very much for listening.